When Patrick had asked me to speak a couple weeks ago, he'd asked me to speak. I found out a little bit later there was also going to be a class. Shoot. But coincidentally, I was putting together some material. I'm going to be teaching at a retreat, a little five-part series at a retreat coming up. And I thought, well, hey, this will be a great opportunity to have just a very brief run-through on a section or maybe two, depending on the time. So for better or worse, you are my guinea pigs today. As the slide indicates, the topic of the series, the retreat I'm going to be doing, is about friendships. And it's, like I said, it's a five-part series, lesson, weekend retreat. And I'm just going to kind of start and visit about one or two of them. Also, I was told that this was going to be a men's class, that all the women were upstairs, the men were downstairs, and that's erroneous too. So I'm in a mess this morning. But let's kind of jump into the class. The topic, like I said, is friendships. And as we get started, I want to show you, I brought just a couple little illustrations. This is a Coke can, just a regular, nothing special Coke can. I have one just like it that I tried to get out of my attic to bring this morning, but it's in a box, buried. It would take me a lot of work, time, energy, effort. It was really, really hot in my attic, so I grabbed this one instead. But picture this is an old Coke can when it had actual sugar in it, those Coke cans. I used to, I'm a recovering youth minister, and one of my very first churches that I was youth minister at was in Kansas City, and I worked with a young man for 2 years, mentoring him before he launched and went to college. And we'd meet every week, and he would go with me to do church work, and I would coach and train him, etc., and it was kind of a mentor-mentee relationship. We got into the Word, we prayed together. He saw the ins and outs of youth ministry, and he went on, actually, to become a youth minister. And we'd meet every week and have a Coke together, and the last session we had before he left for college, he finished the last Coke and set it down. We had our little time together, prayed together, and he was about to throw it away, and he said, no, tell you what, this one you keep. When you think of this, put it on your shelf, reminds you of me. I kept that on my shelf for years, remembering those times and that relationship. Next, these are the old Eisenhowers. It's the old silver dollars. You remember those? They're still in circulation on occasion. You'll come across one of the silver dollars. Every time I would do a youth retreat, I would always take a couple of these with me, every single time. In addition to the theme, we would have our youth stuff going on, the theme for the retreat. But the kids knew, and we told them every time, this is how this works. I'm going to give this coin to two people. And I'm going to tell you that I love you, and I'm going to tell you why. And you give them the coin. Their job is to take that and find somebody, and you're going to go to them and tell them you love them. And tell them why. And so the whole weekend, these are getting passed all around. And people are getting told they're loved and being told why. This was a church in Atlanta. When I left and had my goodbye party, leaving the youth work in Atlanta, the kids surprised me. They made me sit down up front. And they lined up in two lines, each with a silver dollar. And they got in line and they came up and told me that they loved me. And they told me why. Needless to say, I kept these. They mean an awful lot to me. Last one. This is my Bible. I love this Bible. It's a New Testament, NIV, single column, big print, so I can read it with my failing eyesight. This testament actually was given to me by my youth minister, my idol, my mentor growing up. His name was Wally Wilkerson. Wally was, believe this or not, it's true, when I was in high school, my junior and senior year in high school, when we developed this close relationship, he was my age. He was in his 50s. You don't see very many youth ministers in their 50s. He poured into me, telling me his dreams and thoughts for me. This is covered with little underline marks and little notes in the margins, etc. But I was going off to college, going to be facing some difficult challenges. And before I left, he handed me his testament. So I want you to have this. Think of me. Think of our times together. This has been recovered 3-4 times. I don't know how many times. I still use it. Still carry it around with me. This is my testament. When you think about friendships, I hope your minds are going, you're getting that emotion, you're starting to think and picture people that have meant a lot to you. When I thought this was a men's class, I was going to mention something that, you know, the average American male, women have more friends than men. The average American male only has, and I don't even think this is inaccurate, but studies say the average American male only has 2 friends. Honestly, I thought it was 1. I'm shocked that it was actually 2. And think about that. We have a lot of men. We have a lot of acquaintances. We know a lot of people. But do you have any friends? I mean the deep kind of friendship friends. The kind of friend that if you needed something, you could call and they're on that next plane to come see you. Doesn't matter what it is. The kind of friend that if you are in a trouble and you just put out the word, I will empty the bank account, I will do whatever it takes, you can have everything I have. That kind of friend. I'm one of those. I have 2. One of those is in Texas. Well, you might know him. It's Albert Lemons' son. Stephen Lemons, I know I could call day or night, anytime. And the same with him calling me. No matter what, no matter where, I'm there. But we've known each other for 40 years. What do people want most in life? Happiness and fulfillment. Most of those things all come through friends. I thought this was interesting. Psychology Today polled graduating seniors. And they were asked, what do you want most to achieve? What is going to bring you the most happiness? Now, what I thought when I read this and I was reading along, following it, I thought it would be what? Like a car? Or maybe a possessions, a really nice watch? I wasn't sure. But stuff, maybe the American dream, maybe to get married and have a home with a white picket fence, a dog in the yard. Overwhelmingly, the number one response was this: success in personal relationships. Another firm polled the graduating seniors. 87%, what do they want most? Someone with whom to have a significant relationship. When you think about friends, friendships, the friendships you have, what are the traits that you appreciate most, that mean the most about that person or those persons? Shout them out. This is a small enough group. We're informal. What are the traits that mean the most to you about your friends? Sincerity. What? Sincerity. Not blowing smoke. They're being real. Good. Reliability. They're not going to let you down. You can count on them. Excellent. Come on. Interest. Whatever it is you have to share, they are genuinely engaged. They are interested in what you have to say. Good. One more. Positive attitude. They're not Debbie Downer. When you're around them, they actually lift you up instead of pull you down. Excellent. We have some quotes I wanted to show you from different people that are talking about friendships. Aristotle said this, what is friendships? A single soul that dwells in 2 bodies. I like that quote. Cicero, friendship is the only thing in the world concerning the usefulness of which all mankind is agreed. Look at Abraham Lincoln. The better part of one's life consists of his friendships. Martin Luther, the love of God doesn't find, but it creates the object of its love. The love of the human is to seek what it finds to be attractive. Like Emerson here, the only way to have a friend is to be one. There's a lot of truth in that. And Martin Marty, this is so true. We take friends for granted in daily life. But when daily life disintegrates, their sustenance guards and guides our very being. And I found another quote. It's never could find an author to it. It's anonymous. What is a friend? Someone who gives himself or herself for you, who loves you and cares for you, who seeks your own well-being above his or her own, who challenges you to your fullest potential. Psychology Today interviewed young people, middle-aged people, and older people. And I love this survey. It asked the young people, of all your possessions, what means the most to you? For young people, what do you think it was? Cell phones, automobiles. Depending on the socioeconomic, if they're affluent, it was their cars. If they did not have cars, it was like their clothing or stereo, that kind of thing. Okay, next, middle age. What middle age possessions? What meant the most to those of you that are middle age? What do you think it was? Good guess, but I like where your mind's at. No, possessions. House was number one, if they could afford it. If not, if they rented, it was their car. More substantial things, more hefty things, more costly things. Lastly, same survey to the elderly, retirees. What was it for them? No, a possession. Possessions, things that they owned. What was the most value for them? It was. Who said that? Yep. Keep it all right here. It was the photos. Photos. You go into their house, the walls are covered of it. Those are reminders of the things and the experiences and the people that really have the most value. Exactly, it was the pictures that had the most impact for them. Look what Solomon said. We talk about friendships. This is going to be good for the young folks because they select their friends. A mirror reflects a man's face, but what he is really like is shown by the kind of friends that he chooses. And Jesus had a lot to say about friendships too. The greatest love is shown when a person lays down his life for his friends. And you are my friends if you obey me. I no longer call you slaves, for a master does not confide in slaves. Now you are my friends, proven by the fact that I've told you everything that the Father told me. And lastly, I love this quote by Raymond Barrett when he asked about what is a friend. What is a friend? A person with whom you dare to be yourself. Your soul can be naked with him. He seems to ask of you to put on nothing, only to be what you are. Doesn't want you to be better or worse. When you're with your friend, you feel as a prisoner feels who has been declared innocent. You don't have to be on your guard. You can say what you think as long as it is genuinely you. He's like a fire that purges to the bone. You can weep with a friend, laugh with him, pray with them. Through it all and underneath it all, a friend sees, knows, and loves you. What is a friend? A friend is just one to whom you dare to be yourself. I love that. Group Magazine did a little survey about the most famous friendships were in the world at that time. This is going to be a little dated, but I see some of your hair color is similar to mine. You'll probably remember some of these. The most famous friendships were Laverne and Shirley, Kirk and Mr. Spock, the Lone Ranger and Tonto, Bert and Ernie, R2-D2 C-3PO, Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, Captain Kangaroo and Mr. Green Jeans, Simon and Garfunkel, David and Jonathan, one from the Bible made it, I like that, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Little Orphan Annie and Sandy, Gilligan and the Skipper, Charlie Brown and Snoopy, Richie and the Fonz, Little Rascals, E.T. and Elliot, and the commercial made it. I'm not going to inflict you with this, but here's to good friends. Tonight is kind of special. Remember that beer commercial? Denotes that feeling, that sensation, those friendships. To be friends, there's several components, and we're going to touch on a few of those or a couple of those this morning, go through all of them in the retreat. But one I thought was kind of neat I wanted to talk about this morning was physical touch and friendships. Women generally have more friends than men. We've already talked about that. The reason, of course, is conditioning. In our society, except for shaking hands, men are not allowed to touch each other. There's a couple of psychologists, Dick and Paula McDonald, they had this to say. Men have had no practice in the art of intimacy, nor role models to point the way. Little girls can walk to school hand in hand, hold each other up skating, hug and cry and say, "You're my best friend. I need you. I love you." Little boys wouldn't dare. The enormous blackening cloud of homosexuality is always present, and the devastating power of the snicker begins in playground days. Fag is a word every boy learns to fear, and forever after affects his behavior towards other men who might have become his friends. Back in the day, when I grew up, I played a lot of sports through junior high and high school, a little bit in college. And it's okay in the field to show affection. We'd get and stand in a huddle, and we'd all hold hands. We'd come to the line, and we'd run the play, and if something did great, we would hug each other and high-five, slap each other on the rump, and all that was okay as long as you were on the field. But off the field, you would never be allowed. Why is it we can celebrate and hug and jump in a field area of competition, but not on the street, but not in church? Those sexual taboos have gotten just almost insane. I like what a guest, and you're going to, don't judge me, but a guest on Oprah said. She said, it's like this overbearing thing going on. You can't touch parents or offspring, but beware Oedipus. You can't touch siblings, but beware incest. You can't touch close same-sex friends, beware homosexuality. And you can't touch close opposite-sex friends, beware adultery. And you can't touch casual friends, beware promiscuity. You can't touch anybody. And it's having an effect on us. It starts to color everything we read and see on TV and in the movies and in interactions. Listen to this and be self-aware of where your mind goes. Melina Mercury had a book called I Was Born Greek. And Melina wrote this little short paragraph. I want to read it to you. The first man I ever loved was Spiros. He was extremely handsome. Extremely seductive. His mouth smelled sweeter than any man's I've ever known. I adored his embrace, an embrace scented with rosewater and basil. He was strong. He was tall. He had a passion for me. It made my childhood a very happy one. Spiros was my grandfather. But what were you thinking when I first started reading that? Ooh, where's this going? She was talking about the love and the touch for granddaddy. And yet our minds sometimes go directions that shouldn't go. We learn tenderness and softness and gentleness and warmth and security and affection all through touch. And we do it for infants, for babies, and when they get to a certain age, we just stop. And I don't know why. There have been numerous studies done comparing Americans to Parisians. And in Paris, the average Parisian touches each other about 100 times a day. In the United States, Americans touch each other 3 to 4 times a day. 100 times, 3 or 4. There's been so much medical research on touch and how important it is for friends to touch each other. I love some of these doctors' quotes. Dr. Voth, he's with the Menninger Clinic. He says this, hugging, besides helping emotionally, actually helps the immune system. Interesting. Dr. Colton, hugging, he believes, tones the body, prevents disease, and speeds the recovery time for patients. Patients in the hospital, he encourages, hug on them. They get better quicker. Dr. Bressler, this is funny, he prescribes 4 hugs a day without fail. He went on to say, no one ever dies of an overdose, but it does often become addictive. I like that. Ohio State University, oh, you're going to love this, did a study of rabbits. 2 sets of rabbits fed them the exact same diet. 1 set of rabbits were picked up and held and loved on. The other set of rabbits were not. Same diet. The held half had half as much fatty deposits. It helps lose weight. Bowling Green University, proven correlation between drug abusing adolescents and homes with little or no touch. Studies show that cultures with little contact have the highest crime rate, cruelty, and violence rate because they're not touching. No touching does not lead to promiscuity. Actually, it's just the opposite. I spoke at a conference at for law enforcement officers at the Opryland Hotel last year. In a couple of these inner city housing communities, the housing projects, if you will, the average birth rate, actually it was 2 years ago, the average birth rate of the first time birth mother crossed an historic date. It crossed from 16 to 15. Average age of the first time birth mother, 15 and 11 months or whatever. And I was asked, why is it that these young girls are having babies? So young. I mean, they're just 15 years old. They don't even turn 16 yet. Well, it's because there's no males present in the home. What does that have to do with it? Everything. My daughter, she's 22 years old. From the day she was born, I've been hugging on her, kissing her, loving on her, smooching her, tickling her, playing with her. That need is met so that when she turned 15 and 16 years old and some boy tried to put his arm around him, she would say, I don't think so. Do I know you? She didn't need that. I had met that need in her. But picture you're in a home where there's no daddy present. You're being raised by your mother, your grandmother, your auntie. There's no male. And all of a sudden, you turn a certain age, and this 14, 15, 16-year-old boy's put his arms around you. Okay, now that, wait a minute, that kind of feels good. I kind of like that. And he kind of squeezes on her a little bit, and she's so starved for that. That, oh, that's kind of nice. Next thing you know, you got babies. all because of the lack of touch. Those needs are not being met. I like this quote. It feels so good and is so rare that you'll do what is normally out of character and outside your value system in order to be held in love, warmth, and acceptance. You're so starved for it, you'll do what normally is out of character. There is nothing wrong with hugging a buddy, guys. For some reason, we think it's okay to hug a dog, but not a person. I admit I grew up in that home. I never doubted for one moment my father loved me. He was a preacher, Christian, godly man. But I cannot remember a time ever my father hugged me. I don't remember a time he ever said, I love you. Maybe when I was a baby. The closest he got, my wife and I lost our first child, and SIDS. And when he came to the hospital, he was just shaking his head, I can't believe it, and he kind of patted me a little bit on the back. That was the most affection, physical outpouring I'd ever gotten from him. Now, Mom was a hugger, but Dad wasn't. But then you start looking back, thinking that relationship he had with his father. They never hugged. They never touched. There was no demonstrative affection. I mean, my great uncle went off to war, to World War II, and he vividly tells a story that he was leaving. I mean, literally, he's leaving, telling his parents goodbye, knowing I might not come back. Goodbye, Father. Wish me luck. Seriously? Then when they come back, he's alive. Is there any celebration? Welcome home, son. Well, I determined, my wife and I did, that that foolishness stops right now. None of that stuff. My poor son, oh, you got a feel for the kid. He's 24 years old, finishing up his last year of law school. And when I see him in a couple weeks, I'm going to hug the stuffing out of him. I'm going to kiss on his cheeks and tell him how much I love him. He's grown up that way. I've been slobbering on this kid his whole life. He can't help it. And it's working, because I'll be sitting there on the sofa reading a book or watching TV, and he'll come and sit next to me, touching me, and he'll lean his head on my shoulder. It's natural. He needs that. I need it. Sorry, we all need it. We need that touch. My youth minister growing up that gave me this testament, one of his very favorite stories, you remember that childhood story, it meant so much to him because he saw himself in it, was The Velveteen Rabbit. Do you remember that child's book? Cute story. But the rabbit was talking to the skin horse, asking about becoming real, because the rabbit wanted to be more than just a stuffed animal. The rabbit wanted to be real. What is real? Asked the rabbit one day. Real isn't how you are made, said the skin horse. It's something that happens to you. When a child really loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. Does it hurt? Asked the rabbit. Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. When you are real, though, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, he asked, or bit by bit? It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, your eyes drop out, your joints get loose, and you become very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. Oh, love that. He saw himself as the Velveteen Rabbit, because believe you me, being a youth minister all those years, he was my age. I feel like a lot of my hair has been rubbed out, and I'm getting little joints or getting a little bit of shabby. I've been loved hard and put up wet. But he was not ugly. Certainly not to me or to anybody else that didn't understand. I love Ashley Montague. There are more than a half of a million sensory fibers flowing from the skin through the spinal cord to the human brain. A human being can function blind and deaf and completely lacking senses of smell and taste. But it is impossible to survive at all without this function performed by the skin. You can't live without the sense of touch. Remember Emmett Holt Sr., he's a Columbia University professor many, 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 many decades ago. He wrote that book, The Care and Feeding of Children. You remember that? Said you're not to touch children. And those children started dying from the 1800s all the way through the 1930s, died of marasmus, Greek word meaning wasting away. These kids weren't being touched. They weren't being held. They weren't being caressed. And they died. The 1920s, Montague was studying the foundling infant death rate. It was almost 100%, and it was her that realized it's because they aren't getting physical contact. The babies that were touched the most by parents and attendants, by comparison, learned to walk the earliest, talk the earliest, and had the highest IQs. You remember those horrific experiments when they'd have babies, real live babies. We're going to put a bottle in their mouth, or we're going to feed them, but that's it. 100% died. I even came across this ad in the newspaper, Hugs Unlimited. Can you believe a company going into business that you could call and go get hugs if you needed a hug, and they were making a living at it? Jesus touched people over and over and over again. I believe Jesus was a hugger. Matthew 8:3, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the leper. Can you imagine a leper so contagious, no touch? Nobody would get near you because they didn't want to get leprosy. Jesus would touch the leper. Don't you know that meant a lot? Don't you know that sent tingles down their skin? Or Peter's sick mother-in-law, he touched her hand and the fever left her. Or what about Jesus with children? Mothers brought their children to Jesus, and he took them in his arms and blessed them and laid his hands on them. I believe Jesus was a toucher. He was a hugger. And the next trait I want to talk about very briefly, and we're just going to take 5 minutes, and then we'll call it. And that is listening. Good friends learn how to and know how to listen. Listening is a language of love. If you want to be a good friend, you need to learn how to listen. I like this slide. There's about listening. The secret of being interesting is to be interested. That's what you were referring to. That's a very biblical concept. Look at Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others, considering them more important than yourself. I like what Voltaire said. He said, the road to the heart is the ear. People crave to be heard, crave for somebody to listen to me. And just, we're going to fly through this. Just five little quick points. Good listeners. Good listeners listen with their eyes. If you want to be a good friend, want to be a good listener, make good eye contact. You've all been in conversations, you're talking to the person, and they're right in front of you, and what's the person doing? Hey, how's it going? Hey, it's good to see you again. Yeah, uh-huh, okay, that's an interesting story. Uh-huh, yeah, right. And they're looking everywhere except at you. They're not engaged, they're not listening. I'm going to call him out because he's so good at it. Joe Whitehouse. Oh, my goodness. He'll come up to you and get right in your face. Hey, how's it going? And it's like he really wants to know. And he's looking at you. And there could be a marching band and dancing poodles going on behind him, and his eyes are right there locked on yours. And he wants to know, how's it going? You think if I'm hurting or in a crisis, who am I going to go to? I'm going to Joe Whitehouse. Wouldn't it be great if they could go to you? If you engage like that, listen with your eyes, engage like, be present. Secondly, good listeners dispense advice sparingly. If somebody comes to you and say, can we talk? I've got an issue. I need to unburden myself. Can we talk? That's not what they're asking. What they're really wanting to know is, can we go somewhere? I need to unburden myself. I need to talk. I need you to shut up and listen. Can you do that for me? That's what they want to know. Even though they might ask your advice, your opinions, or whatever, most often they just need somebody to listen. I love what the Washington Post said. Never give advice. The ignorant won't heed it, and the wise don't need it. Third, good listeners never break a confidence. If someone tells you something in confidence, keep it there. And it's perfectly okay. I've had this happen that somebody will come to me, hey, Chris, I need to tell you something. I need to get something off of my chest, but don't tell Joe anything about it. Depending on the person, but quite often I've done this, then don't tell me. I'm going to tell her everything, and then don't tell me. It's best you don't. Sometimes they say, oh, it's okay, you can tell her, but nobody else. Believe you me, I tell her and nobody else. Fourth, good listeners look to the other. Best analogy I ever heard about this one, and this will make the point home, I think. This was years and years and years ago, back before World War II days. Two statesmen took out the same woman. They took her out within two or three nights of each other. She was very well known. They were very well known. The newspapers asked her afterwards, tell me about your date with these two men. Listen to what she had to say. When I left the dining room after sitting next to Mr. Gladstone, I thought he was the cleverest man in all of England. But after sitting next to Mr. Disraeli, I thought I was the cleverest woman in England. Who's she going to be likely to go out with again? Who is a better friend? Somebody that impressed her with how smart I am, or someone that made her feel like a little queen about how smart she was? Who genuinely valued and sought out her opinion? Lastly, good listeners show gratitude for somebody that confides. It wasn't that many years ago, 4 years ago, that I went through one of the most difficult spiritual challenges and struggles of my life. Satan had kicked my little hind end horribly. And there were two people in this congregation that I went to, two elders, and separately, and I said, this is what's going on in my life. This is a struggle. This is the battle I'm engaged in, and I am losing big time. The first one I unloaded with and talked, I prattled on for probably 40 minutes nonstop. He sat there the whole time and didn't say a word. When I finished, she said, it's not that I'm not interested, but I'm providing these for you. Talk as long as you want. And the other man, again, the same thing. He interrupted me one time and saying, I'm not really interrupting. I just want you to know I am listening, but you keep talking. And they both said the same thing when we were done, and I just, metaphorically, I had opened the kimono. They had seen me in all my glory and all my shame. And they both said the same thing. I've never felt closer to you than I do at this moment. But I just got through unveiling and telling you what a horrible failure I am and how I've been involved in this horrific sin, and you're telling me that you never felt closer to me. No judgment, no condemnation, just love. And the last thing I want to say in closing, not part of this, but the last slide. This is the best advice I could give anybody. If you go make a hospital visit, if you go see somebody that's had some kind of tragic loss, if you're going to show up and provide help, counsel for someone that's gone through a divorce, I could go on and on, any kind of horrific situation there is. The best advice I can give you is twofold. Show up and shut up. There is nothing you could say, unless it's a TV show, that you're going to impart some little words of wisdom and they're going to think, huh, you know, I've never thought about that way. Thank you so much for sharing. Now I feel better. My problem's solved because of that little nugget of wisdom you gave me. You ain't that good. Show up. You're present. You're there. I'm here for you. I'm going to listen. I'm going to support you. I'm going to be there for you. And then be quiet. As I mentioned before, I'll never forget it. When we lost our first child, one lady came up to me because we had heard some horrific things. People coming to give advice to make us feel better. They said the most hurtful, ugly things. Not intentionally. This one lady came and walked up to me with tears in her eyes and just hugged me and just left. She never uttered a word. That was the most impactful, that was the biggest blessing I could have gotten from that lady who showed up, didn't say a word. There's nothing you can say. Hopefully that helps. I appreciate very much the opportunity to share with you. Y'all have been wonderful, and y'all go out and have a blessed day.